welcome to Notes from the Western Edge, a monthly 30-minute on-demand webcast featuring musicians who create on the edges of jazz, new music, electronics, and a broad expanse of sonic spaces in between. In program number 8, we'll hear from two pioneers of electronic music, Pauline Oliveros and Carol Stone. Over a 50-year period, Pauline Oliveros has been one of the prime innovators in new music. In 1962, she co-founded the San Francisco Tape Music Center. In 1966, she deployed one of the first tape delay systems in her piece, 104. Besides that, she's been known to play a pretty mean accordion. Just give her a listen, you'll see. Carol Stone has been immersed in bits and bytes since day one, way, way before Danger Mouse. Stone was appropriating musical materials for use in his own music. Today we call it sampling. Back then, we didn't know what to call it. Not only that, he names most of his pieces after restaurants. Interested? Tune in. I hope you enjoy the show. This was the first record of electronic music I ever bought, back in 1969 or 70. As you can hear, it's got some pops and clicks on it, like most vinyl records do. Initially, I was attracted to the album because it contained Come Out by Steve Reich, a piece that had completely blown me away the first time I heard it. I had never heard of Richard Maxfield or Pauline Oliveros, the other two composers on the disc. Wow, was I in for a surprise. The story behind this disc is worth telling before we begin exploring Pauline Oliveros' work. In 1968, Wendy Carlos, then known as Walter, released Switched on Bach, an album of Johann Sebastian Bach's music played on the then little-known Moog synthesizer. The album was a huge crossover hit, staying on Billboard's Pop Top 10 for 17 weeks and winning 3 Grammy Awards in 1969. CBS saw all of this and thought, let's do some more of this. So they hired avant-garde composer David Behrman to produce a series of electronic music albums for the Music of Our Time series, thus giving birth to new sounds in electronic music, which included 104 by Pauline Oliveros. With all due respect to Carlos and to Bach, to my ears, this is the far superior album, containing some truly groundbreaking music by three visionary composers, although to CBS's disappointment, it didn't win any Grammys. You often hear the word pioneer used, and sometimes misused, in discussions of directions in music and the musicians who created them. To me, the word has never been applied more accurately than it has to Pauline Oliveros. Over the past 40 years, she hasn't pioneered in just one aspect of music, but in many. Electronic music, improvisation, vocal music, audience participation, women's music, and more. Take 104, created by Oliveros in July 1966 while she was a student at the University of Toronto. What is most amazing about this piece, aside from its gorgeous electronic soundscape, is the way Oliveros created all of the sounds from sounds we can't hear. Let me explain. Oliveros used 12 sine wave generators, known as oscillators, each of which would sound like a pure test tone if tuned within the range of human hearing, which runs from about 20 vibrations per second, a really low pitch, up to about 20,000 cycles per second, a really, really high pitch, way past the top note on the piano. In most electronic music, composers tune their oscillators within the range of human hearing. In 104, Oliveros did something completely different. She tuned 11 of the oscillators above the range of human hearing, and one of them way below it, actually below one cycle per second. Oliveros also used one of the first tape delay systems by recording on one tape deck and playing back on another deck 8 seconds later. By the way, this was 6 years before Brian Eno and Robert Fripp released their first work with tape delay systems. All of the sounds you are hearing were made by the 11 super high oscillators, interacting with oscillators built into the electronics of the tape recorders, with all of that modulated or changed by the oscillator tuned below one cycle per second. The summer she created this music, Oliveros encountered some resistance from her teacher.
The director of the electronic music studio was teaching a course that summer in electronic music, and he knew how to make electronic music. So he was teaching electronic music techniques, and I wasn't using any of those. I was using my own. So he would come into the studio in the morning and find all of the bank of 12 oscillators set above the range of hearing, and one of them below the range of hearing. And he said, "You can't make any sound with that."
Well, obviously you can.
I did.
Before we move on to more recent music by Oliveros, here's an excerpt from near the end of 1 of 4. As a child growing up in Houston, Oliveros began playing the accordion in 1942 and continues to play it to this day. Over the years, she's composed much music for the accordion, as well as performing many improvisations both solo and with others. We're listening to music she composed for the Mabu Mines production of Lear by William Shakespeare, released in a concert version called Crone Music on the Lovely Music label. As you can hear, Oliveros' accordion doesn't always sound like your typical accordion.
This expanded instrument system, which is something that I have developed over the last 35 years, starting with tape delay systems, now with computer software, enables me to record sounds as I play and to have the recording come back at specified time intervals. When these sounds come back, they can be modified so that the sounds are transformed, maybe in pitch transformation or timbre transformation or different things. And they also are spatialized so that the sound can appear in any of 8 or less channels, depending on what kind of a sound system is available. If there's 8 channels is ideal, because then I have what I call sound geometries, so that sound goes out to, it can travel around the 8 speakers in a circle or in a triangle or any of 10 different patterns.
Even with just 2 channels, as in the stereo recording, the effect of this spatial transformation is very evocative, especially through headphones. Thank you. For many years, Oliveros has composed music that addresses social and political issues. This is Tara's Room, a multi-track recording for which Oliveros created all of the instrumental and vocal sounds. Tara's Room is dedicated to all who have lost loved ones whose lives were taken by war. In 1970, while teaching at the University of California at San Diego, Oliveros began creating what she calls sonic meditations for groups of people to perform together. She told me that events towards the end of the 1960s, the Vietnam War, the assassinations of Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr., and the self-immolation of an anti-war student on the UCSD campus in May 1970, all contributed to her decision to bring people together in peace through music.
I was very affected by all of that, of course. How could I not be? And my reaction to it was turning inward to what I developed as sonic meditations, and I felt that it should be possible for everyone to take part in sound experiences that had a meditative or calming effect, and that participation was a key word. I mean, a key concept, idea, key way of creating community.
In 1985, after 14 years of teaching at UCSD, Oliveros moved to Kingston, New York, and founded the Pauline Oliveros Foundation to support the creation of new works. That year, she also founded the Deep Listening Institute around her concept and technique of deep listening. In 1998, at Cooper Union in New York City, she described what led her to define the practice of deep listening after receiving a gift from her mother. She said, "Shortly after receiving the gift of my tape recorder in 1953, I placed the microphone in the window of my San Francisco apartment and recorded the sound environment. Little did I realize the extent of the impact this simple act would have on me. Although I thought I was listening while recording, I was surprised to find sounds on the tape that I had not heard consciously. With this discovery, I gave myself a meditation. Listen to everything, all the time, and remind yourself when you're not listening. 45 years later, I'm still doing this meditation as the core of a practice that I call deep listening." In addition to her personal practice of deep listening, and to her life as a composer and performer, Oliveros was and still is instrumental in some very significant centers for the creation of cutting-edge music. In 1960, she and Ramon Sender began assembling a tape music studio in the attic of the San Francisco Conservatory. 2 years later, that morphed into the San Francisco Tape Music Center in the legendary Haight-Ashbury neighborhood, where every so often, well-known psychedelic rockers were known to stop by to check out the new electronic sounds. 4 years after that, the center morphed once again, this time into the Center for Contemporary Music at Mills College, of which Oliveros was the first director. Currently, Oliveros teaches by audio-visual telepresence at Mills and in person in the Electronic Arts Department of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York. In 2008, RPI will complete its new $140 million Experimental Media Performing Arts Center, which will hold a 1,200-seat auditorium, a 500-seat theater, plus additional black box theaters and studios in which electronic artists can create their work. Quite a leap from a couple of tape recorders in a San Francisco attic in 1960. I fully expect that we will see many more creative leaps from Pauline Oliveros as the future unfolds. In Los Angeles, for Notes from the Western Edge, I'm Richard Paskey. you think you know where this music is going? I don't think so. What about now? Any thoughts on where this might go? Okay, one more time. To understand the evolution of the music we're listening to, it helps to hear the composer talk about it. Here's Carl Stone, talking about his early days as a composer.
I became interested in using appropriated musical material as source for my own music in the 70s, even while I was a student. If listening to some of my experiments in those days, I had begun to work with material that I found in the CalArts Music Library, mixing them with electronic materials. And then 1979 is sort of when I officially date the kickoff to my professional work as a composer. 1979, my piece Sukhothai, which used Baroque music, one particular piece from Henry Purcell, a harpsichord piece, to generate the entire form and process of the finished work.
But in 1979, samplers didn't exist, and personal computers were barely past their infancy.
Even in those pre-computer days, I was doing a kind of proto-sampling. But then, of course, when the computer came along and was small enough and powerful enough and affordable enough for me to use, then I started doing what is officially called sampling.
And what exactly is sampling?
The digital encoding of recorded sound and then manipulating it via a computer to musical ends.
The first time I interviewed Carl Stone was in 1985 at the Fair Oaks Motel in Minneapolis, where he was staying while presenting his music at Walker Arts Center. At the time, he was using a French-made Publison digital delay and harmonizer unit, which suffered an unfortunate fate around Christmas time of that year.
That box was stolen, burglarized out of my studio in Los Angeles. It was expensive, and the insurance money was enough to buy almost an entire studio just to with the funds to replace that one box.
Maybe it was time for an equipment change anyway. Today's digital technologies tend to follow Moore's Law, which states that the number of transistors per square inch on a computer chip doubles every 18 months. In the world of digital music, that means that musicians can record more tracks, process and play more notes, and produce a cleaner, more refined sound than they could a year and a half ago. For Stone, the theft of his Publison meant that he could make the next step.
I had switched over. I no longer used the Publison and had started using a Macintosh, an Apple, as a kind of an instrument on stage, driving a bunch of MIDI gear samplers and synthesizers and things like that.
Today, Stone doesn't even need the synthesizers or the samplers, and he doesn't need a traditional keyboard either, even though he took years of piano lessons as a child. All he needs for his live gigs is a laptop.
QWERTY, that's my keyboard.
QWERTY being a nickname for the standard computer keyboard. We're listening to Moms from Stone's 1992 album of the same name on New Albion Records. Moms doesn't refer to his mother, but instead to one of many restaurants that he has enjoyed over the years. Almost all of his pieces are named after restaurants. Here's another one, Bante Shrey. While listening to the gentle sway of this music, created for the video project titled Recurring Cosmos, let's listen to Stone talk about his early musical influences.
I listened to a lot of music when I was a kid. I loved folk music and I loved classical music and was kind of, you know, a 10-year-old opera buff. When I was in high school, I did listen to a lot of rock and roll. I loved Jimi Hendrix and Jefferson Airplane and Captain Beefheart and the Mothers of Invention and a lot of stuff like that. You know, like a lot of people, Frank Zappa pointed us to... Frank Zappa and the Beatles pointed us to avant-garde composers of the 20th century like Cage and Stockhausen and so on. So I listened to those. I loved the British group called the Soft Machine. They were very influential to my musical style when I was in high school.
Stone creates most of his recent work on a Macintosh laptop running Max MSP, software that allows musicians to write their own programs for performing, recording, and processing music. This piece, Kreutz, was made on such a system and was recorded live at the Schindler House in Los Angeles. Stone describes his performance process.
I have a hard disk which is just full of, I have really no idea, maybe 15, 20 gigabytes of audio files, musical files. Some are short, some are longer. And they serve as a kind of database for which I can pull out material at, you know, a moment's notice. So these sounds that I have recorded on the hard drive can be pulled up at a moment's notice. And that's really what I'm doing. I'm sort of selecting them and then processing them in different ways by cutting them up or mixing them together, extending them in time, compressing them, and so on and so forth.
Besides composing and performing music, over the years Stone produced Imaginary Landscape and Ears Wide Open, radio programs featuring new music. I asked him about his involvement with radio. First, how he got started.
I came into it working at KPFK, which was the Pacifica station in Los Angeles. I started as a volunteer in the very beginning, editing tapes of the Watergate hearings. They would give me a tape of all the hearings and I'd have to edit them down into 90 minutes. And I did this, you know, almost on a daily basis over the summer of 1973 as a volunteer. And then by 77 or so, I was volunteering for the music department, which I was, in a way, a little more at home with. By 78, I was doing a regular program there. No, by 77, I was doing a regular program there. And by 78, I was the music director there. And continued to do programming after I left as music director and became a volunteer again.
For Stone, radio was a powerful outlet for music and ideas, one close to his heart.
I love radio. I mean, in its day, then in the pre-internet age and even after the beginning of the internet, I think radio is just a wonderful, wonderful medium of communication and mutual exploration about music. I loved, you know, in KPFK in its heyday, did more than just, you know, have people come in and bring the music that they love and play it and talk about it, but we did a lot of live performances and many interviews with composers and performers, and we could do stuff that other radio stations could not do. For example, John Cage reading Empty Words, you know, piece with 13-minute silences and things like that. You can't do that on the radio these days. And we did Sati Vexations. I produced a performance of the complete Sati Vexations, 25 hours.
Later, Stone said that their Vexations, composed in 1893 and considered by many to be the first minimalist music, might have been a mere 19 hours long. But whether it was 19 or 25, the point is that Stone and KPFK were not afraid to go way out on a limb and present music way outside of the mainstream. Currently, Stone is living and teaching in Japan, where being outside of the mainstream is a daily fact of life for him.
As an American, a non-Japanese, one will always be an outsider in Japan in any endeavor. That's just the way it goes. And that's fine with me. And, you know, I have a certain history. I mean, I started going to Japan, the first time was 1984, and I was one of the first people to, you know, use a computer as a performance instrument in Japan. And, you know, a lot of Japanese, when they're honest about it, do say that the work that I did and a couple of other people around the same time was very influential to them. And so, for some reason, and this makes me feel very old, but, you know, some people refer to me as a kind of a grandfather figure. Father, I could, you know, I might still feel a little old, but grandfather, that's going too far, don't you think?
Whatever you say, Carl. But seriously, I believe that Stone can definitely be counted among the forefathers of live electronic music performance in the digital age, one whose work continues to resonate with the currents of our time. In Los Angeles, for Notes from the Western Edge, I'm Richard Paskey. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show. Next time we'll hear from two trumpeters, one from each coast, Dave Douglas from the East and the chairman of the Jazz Studies Program at the University of Southern California, Ron McCurdy. In Los Angeles, for Notes from the Western Edge and Fresh Ears Media, I'm Richard Paskey. Until next time, keep listening.